The Outspoken Cyclist podcast is supported by the Dodd Camera Company. An Ohio institution in photography for over 100 years, Dodd Camera has stayed right in step with the newest in digital cameras and accessories, as well as offering services such as photo restoration and large format printing. Dodd Camera stores are located in Cleveland, Dayton, Cincinnati, Chicago, and now Columbus in the Oak Creek Shopping Center on Cameron Avenue. If you don't have one in your town, you can find them online at doddcamera.com. At Dodd Camera, the focus is on you.
Time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello, welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for December 2nd, 2017. Yep, the year's almost over. It seems pretty bizarre to me, especially since it was over 60 degrees here in Northeast Ohio earlier in the week, and we were able to go grab an afternoon ride. This week's show is a bit more focused on some perspectives about the economy and business, including, of course, the bike business, and some pretty heady insights. My first guest is Nelson Repenning, the Distinguished Professor of Systems Dynamics and Organization Studies at MIT's Sloan School of Management. It's a mouthful, but Nelson, who raced his bike pretty successfully back in the day, has his finger on the pulse of business as it relates to jobs, manufacturing, the economy, and much more. Nelson also has a consulting firm, Shift Gear, that helps companies figure out those things that always seem to sabotage success, or at least slow it down. He's also a really nice guy. After a short break, we're going to head from Boston up to Vermont to speak with master mechanic Merlin Townley. Last time we spoke was way back in 2012. Merlin was in Chattanooga then, and we talked race mechanics. Today, however, he's got some things to say about the bike business and about race mechanic training, as well as a perspective on the bike shop mechanic that maybe you haven't heard. Finally, our holiday gift is actually a book by someone who has been in the studio and on the show more than once. Doug Bannock has Parkinson's disease, yet he continues to ride his bike on some pretty amazing and challenging rides, even for someone who doesn't suffer from a disorder that may many times make it just difficult to hold on to the bars. Doug has ridden across Alaska. You might remember his journey from our last conversation, as well as across Oregon and South Korea. In his new book, The White Line to Denver, Doug details his trip from Boise, Idaho to Denver, Colorado, a trip his doctor suggested he probably shouldn't take. But if you remember him at all, you know that Doug's answer to that was, well, I'll let him tell you. So first, let's head on up to Boston to speak with Professor Nelson Repenning. Hello, Nelson. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me today.
Yeah, it's my pleasure to be here. Thank you.
It's my pleasure. So when Mike King says I should talk to somebody, I want to know more. And so I have to tell you what he said. He said, and I'll quote him, grill him like a fish. So I guess I have to ask you a whole bunch of questions. How do you know Michael?
So he was one of the first people I met in bike racing in the North Shore of Chicago in the 1981, probably. He was probably the best rider that was from where I lived, and he was certainly the coolest. So he was pretty much my hero when I was a kid.
He's a pretty cool guy.
Yeah.
He was my rep for a long time for all the top brands, you know. So I liked Mike a lot. Tell us a little bit about your background, where you grew up, and a bit about your riding and racing career. And, you have to tell me, because I already know that you really did have, even if it was short, a racing career.
I did. So I grew up in the North Shore of Chicago, and, you know, it was the place well documented in all the John Hughes movies like The Breakfast Club and Ferris Bueller's Day Off and so on and so forth. And in the town I grew up in happened to be RRV Cycles. And when I was 12 years old, 11 actually, I started hanging out at the shop, and Ron Boy, who was the owner, you know, sort of took me under his wing, and I just fell in love with the sport. And so I started riding on weekends with the guys that used to hang out at his shop, and they were all very nice to me and would take me out and drop me and feed me when I ran out of food and bring me home. And then from there, I started racing for Ron and raced pretty avidly for about 10 years. And I loved the sport. I loved everything about it. It was a fabulous experience. You know, I wasn't the best ever, but I had some nice results along the way. And I got to meet a ton of great people.
You know, a lot of people would have continued to follow that trajectory, and you did not. Do you still follow bike racing today?
It's interesting. After 10 years, so this would have been probably 1991, I graduated from college, and my parents had been very patient with me through high school and college about bike racing, but they were starting to look at me a little bit cross-eyed, like, you know, where are you going to go with this? And I thought really seriously about seeing if I could make it, you know, kind of in the low-grade professional ranks, but I just probably wasn't quite good enough to get where I wanted, would have wanted to be. And so I left the sport and went to graduate school, ended up becoming a professor. And I didn't really pay that much attention to the sport. I mean, obviously, when Armstrong and company were doing really well, I would watch the Tour de France in the summer and so on and so forth. But in actually the last few years, I've started to start riding more and getting back into it. So it's been a very interesting experience. I've been so involved with it 30 years ago, and then now to, in some sense, return to it and see how things have, what's stayed the same and what's changed.
Oh, well, you know what? That's a really interesting point. What do you see that's changed?
Well, so a couple things have changed, which is bikes are way cooler now than they were 30 years ago. I'm wowed by the technology that is available, like electronic shifting and so on and so forth. And I think that's only because, you know, I didn't see it improve incrementally. I went from, you know, circa 1990 to circa 2015 in one step. But, you know, more substantively, obviously the sport is many times more popular now than it was before. Last year, we had a reunion for the RRB Cycles team, and I went home and went riding with all my old teammates. And it was just funny to do our old rides 25 years later and see that there must have been five times more people out for a ride than there were back in the day. So it's definitely grown significantly. But, you know, as you probably know better than me, I think the channels through which the sport is delivered have changed pretty dramatically. So it's not just your local high-end bike shop anymore. There's much more online sales, which it seems to have changed things a little bit.
A little bit. I think there's an understatement there, Nelson. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
So obviously you are still riding. What kind of bike did you get?
Well, so the day that I went to, this is the first road bike I bought in literally 25 years. I spent an afternoon at the bike shop, and, you know, again, was to me, it was like science fiction to see all the new technology. And I spent hours, you know, I'm sure the sales guy was getting tired of me, but I ended up buying a Colnago CX, which I absolutely love, and been riding it ever since.
You know, it's interesting that you're in a town where you could buy pretty much anything. You know, you could buy a 7, you could buy a 44. There are all kinds of bike makers there, and yet you ended up with what I would consider a production bike, even though it's a super high-end production bike. But yeah. I just found that interesting. So let me just, I'm just going to ask you a question about the size of the bike. How big, what size is it?
Well, I don't even quite understand how it's measured. You know, so I'm obviously the same size or slightly shorter than I was 30 years ago.
Right.
So I used to ride a 56 centimeter frame. This one is labeled 52, you know, which I presume means that the seat tube is shorter and there's more seat posts or something like that, or else I lost 4 centimeters along the way. Mostly because I'd ridden before, I just rode a bunch of them that afternoon and picked the one that felt the best to me. And I'll be honest that the custom route, or like the 7s I see on the road, wasn't really on my radar at the time, although, you know, next time I'm in the market, I might look a little bit more widely.
Well, you know, I guess I'll just have to be blunt and say you're not getting any younger, right?
Sadly, no.
Anyway, let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Nelson, Dr. Nelson Repenning. He is a professor at MIT. He is a past bike rider and racer, but it's what he does in work right now that really interests me. Tell me about what you do at MIT and your company, Shift Gear.
Sure. So it's I divide my sort of professional career into two pieces, which is about the first half of my time. I've been at MIT for 25 years. So for about the first half, I did pretty traditional research here, at least what happens in business schools, that was largely focused on explaining in a variety of different industries why people didn't use the tools and processes that we would all agree are good things to do. So why don't car makers use the Toyota production system? Why don't people who run oil refineries and nuclear power plants, you know, use well-established safety practices and so on? And that work, the important part of the story, was very diagnostic in the sense that I was trying to come up with a story about why people wouldn't do seemingly obvious things.
Yeah. Do I dare ask why? Or is that just one of those, yeah, because they're people?
No. Well, so it turns out there's some good reasons for this. Not good as in desirable particularly, but good in that once you understand the psychology and how people interact with these things, it becomes a lot easier to understand. And it basically boils down to the following sort of issue, which may be more detailed than anybody wants, which is that if you dig into the psychology, that the human brain is essentially wired through millions of years of evolution to go towards things that provide immediate reward, right? So we like sugar because it tastes good, and, you know, we run away when we see lions and so on and so forth. And that evolutionary wiring is still a big part of the human cognitive architecture. And it turns out that all the tools and practices that I was studying were things that have a sort of peculiar flavor, which is that if you do them right, nothing happens. You know, so a simple example is safety. If you run a fabulous safety program in a factory or a nuclear power plant, nothing goes wrong, which is exactly what you want. But it turns out that doesn't interact with our brains very well because we don't get that dopamine surge every time something happens. And so the basic punchline was, once you understood sort of or matched it with the psychology, this isn't a set of things that humans are going to be naturally good at. And so it's not surprising from at least a scholarly point of view why we would see persistent underinvestment in these kinds of practices, even though at some high level we would know that they're all good things to do. And so, you know, the way I sort of characterize my career transition is, so for about 10 years I worked on this, and I had a fabulous story that I could tell about why we screwed all these things up. And then usually at about the end of a session, someone would ask me and say, okay, I get it. I understand why we don't do it. What do I do about it? And usually what I would do is look at my watch and just hope the session was almost over because I didn't really have a good answer to how to solve the problem.
Okay.
And so what I've been working on since then is to try to give people more practical advice about, if you have this set of problems, you know there's a right thing to do, but you can't get your organization to do it. How do you get them to do it? And the basic sort of punchline of all of that is a really simple idea, but, you know, every day that I work on it, it seems more powerful, which is find ways to make those activities more visual so people can see them and see when they're making progress. Because it turns out that human beings, not surprisingly, are very visual characters. And again, kind of back to the psychology, we're very wired to deal with physical stuff. And so a world in which we get most of our work done via email and Microsoft Project file is not something that evolution actually particularly designed us to do. So anything we can do to give that so-called knowledge work a more physical manifestation will almost always help people get it done better.
So a demonstration in front of you as to how something might work is going to be more effective than reading about it on a piece of paper that says these are our best practices.
Exactly right. And I'll give you my favorite example. So if you think about a factory like that's making bicycles or motorcycles or cars, if the production line were to stop, everybody knows about it immediately because it generates a clear visual signal, and people would naturally run over the production line and say, what's wrong? How come you're not making bicycles? If you contrast that with knowledge work, so say the R&D process that designs that bicycle, that project may be stuck on someone's desk, but because it doesn't generate a clear visual signal, it might be days or weeks or months before anybody knows about it, and as a consequence, it tends not to be managed very well. So often what we do to make projects work better is just tell the people who are doing the project, get it out of your email or your project file and put all your activities on Post-its so that we can see a move on the whiteboard and we can see which ones are ahead and which are behind. So as simple a technology as you could possibly imagine, but just giving it that physical, tangible manifestation turns out to make a big difference.
Yeah, that really does sound like something that's very simple, but that probably makes a huge difference. So let's talk about the old dog, you know, not learning new tricks. And that is, what do you think is going on in the independent bicycle dealer channel? in the era of online selling? What kinds of things do you think a retailer might do to shift, using the shift gear term, their current ways of doing business to compete in the market today? And today's a really cool day. It's Cyber Monday, right?
Right, exactly. You know, so I should say at the outset that my answer here will be overly influenced by my experience with the local bike shops around here, whose I won't mention any names.
That's fine.
And, you know, there may be other places around the world that run differently. But definitely one of the big lessons from lots of service businesses, whether it's banking or casinos, and I believe it applies to bike racing, to cycling, although I don't know as well, is I think you need to know your market and to treat your, you know, your high margin customers really well. And I think this is probably the only competitive weapon that probably your independent bike dealer has relative to online sales. And at least the shops that I have visited, again, you know, it's a tiny subset of all the ones that are out there. I think sometimes it doesn't feel like they quite understand who their high rollers are. You know, if you take the casino analogy, you know, cycling's a very subtle sport, right? The bike needs to fit. There's a lot of different technology involved. There's clothing. And if you're new to the sport, you know, it all seems very exotic and complicated. You know, a face-to-face interaction in that environment is always going to be better than, you know, no matter how many reviews that I read on Amazon. The much overused buzzword nowadays is curate, but I do think it has some truth in this context. But at least the places I go, I don't feel like they really leverage that advantage and, you know, take the time to really educate the possible new high-margin customer that's going to come in about the sport, where to get engaged, and so on and so forth. And I don't know, that's just my instinct, but it feels like they're missing the opportunity to maybe build the market just a little bit.
How do you counter the discount mentality? Although I seem to think it might be shifting some. So people would say, well, I go, it used to be come into the shop. They'd even flash the catalogs from places like Nash Bar and Performance, for example, and then try on all your shoes and all your clothes and then go and order it or, you know, whatever. Today, everything also is instantaneous. You know, Amazon will deliver it to you in one day, whatever it is. So what do you think the counter is for a retailer with a brick and mortar store who has to deal with the pricing question? Now, I agree with you that your high roller isn't looking at pricing first, looking at service and what he or she learns first. But, you know, there are other people we want to bring into the sport, right?
Yeah, and I'm not sure I have the magical answer to that. And it's funny, in getting ready for this conversation, I was thinking about this a little bit and comparing it to other sports that I do. And I think, so you're always going to have the person that will come in and try on all your shoes and is going to go home and order on Amazon. And I'm not sure that's entirely avoidable. But I do sense that the more that shops build a community where when I go to that shop, I don't feel like it's just a transaction, but I'm really buying into something. You know, the more people are going to sort of stay engaged. And, you know, when I first started riding at RRB a gazillion years ago, there was a really strong community around the shop. We all rode together and we hung out together. And I think it created a lot of sort of affinity with the store, whether it was group rides and so on and so forth. And I don't really get the sense that people do as much. And maybe litigation makes it harder for shops to sponsor that kind of activity. I don't really know. But I think it's developing a connection. And there is actually good research on this. Psychologically speaking, people love to connect to something that's bigger than themselves. And human beings are very social animals. So I think to the extent that your independent bike dealer can create a community around the activity and the mutual enjoyment of the sport, you know, that can only help. Now, I guess in the end, it's a cost-benefit trade-off whether those extra investments are worth it. But my guess is, you know, if you live in a big enough area like around where I live, my guess is it probably would be.
Yeah, I would think Boston is a really good cycling community from commuter all the way through high-end racer. You have them all there, and people ride bikes all the time. But we live in Cleveland. It's changing, but it isn't there yet. And I see that the shops are, you know, some of them are struggling. Some of them are doing very well, but some of them are struggling. I want to shift from just bicycle to just the future of business in the U.S. So, you know, it's the big topic. We want to grow the economy. We want more jobs. Blah, blah, blah. It seems to me unemployment is pretty low,
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm not real sure where this is going. And what do you think might be missing from our economy or that needs to be shifted to keep the economy on track? I don't believe that it's everything we're being told, and who knows what's fake news and what isn't.
Such a fabulous question. And, you know, the other 124 colleagues I hear at the MIT Business School would love to chime in on it as well, but you'll get me for now. To me, the most compelling data that I've looked at on this topic recently is a graph that one of my colleagues here shows that shows the growth in productivity in the United States and the growth in real wages. And if you type this into Google, you can find this on a whole bunch of websites. And basically what you find is that, I maybe get the numbers off slightly, but between 1980 and today, productivity in the United States has grown more than fourfold, maybe even fivefold. But average wages have actually hardly moved an inch in real dollars. And that actually contrasts very sharply with from the end of World War II to about 1980 when productivity and wages rose together, right? Which would sort of make more intuitive sense, which is if I can produce more widgets, I'm going to get paid more. And that was true for 20 or 30 years, and it hasn't really been true since then. And I think if you put that together, it explains so many of the challenges that we face today. So income inequality in the United States is at a historic high. You know, and again, you probably all see the statistics that, you know, the wealthy earn an enormous fraction of all the income in the country. Now, we're not to sort of third world levels yet, but we're headed in that direction. And so I think although unemployment is very, very low, I'm not sure that all those jobs that are at the bottom end of the income spectrum are the ones that we would necessarily hope for. There's been a huge move towards the service economy. Manufacturing in the United States has, to a large degree, moved overseas. And so it's created some real sort of structural challenges. And, you know, depending on whether your blood flows red or blue, politically speaking, you have different parts of that story that you're unhappy with. But certainly the kind of major political shift that we've had, whether you like it or not, is in large part driven by, you know, folks that live in the central part of the United States that aren't necessarily happy with the jobs they have. So I think there's some real structural issues that we're facing that are not entirely captured by the fact that unemployment is currently low. And I think that that growing income inequality is going to be something that has to be addressed, if for no other reason than history would suggest it creates a lot of social unrest, which I think is exactly what we're seeing. Actually,
we are seeing that. I agree. So I have another question that's sort of related to that. Here in Northeast Ohio, where a lot of the jobs, and I'll use the word blue collar, even though that may or may not be accurate today, were steel or auto jobs. And everybody talked years ago about being quote unquote retrained. And I had the sense that people became sort of resigned and didn't want new training. They wanted their old jobs back. So I'm not sure how you sort of put those two together. You need to learn something new and you don't want to learn something new. So the jobs today are not the same as they were. How do they expect us to look at manufacturing today? It's not the same.
Yeah, I think it's a real hard problem. And, you know, retraining is definitely part of the solution. I'm not sure it's ever going to be all the solution, only because, you know, particularly in manufacturing, at least some of the evidence suggests that there's just going to be, you know, need for fewer people. There's more automation. And the character of the jobs that remain are different. You're going to have more technicians. You're going to have more people that are programming and doing software stuff and just fewer folks that are doing, you know, the kind of more manual components, although I think that's not declining as rapidly as some people would argue. I'm not sure robots are taking over the world just yet.
Right, not yet.
But we do have, you know, a major structural problem, which is that, and I actually think we've made this worse in some sense for reasons I'll get to in a moment, but we have tended to send manufacturing to low-wage countries. And you see that the low-wage country of choice changes when the wages in that country tend to go up, right? So first it was going to be Japan, and then it was to China, and, you know, then it's other Asian countries. And, you know, if they could ever get their political act together, I actually think that, you know, eventually Africa is going to become the next low-wage country. Now, once we sort of raise the standard of living there, I'm not sure what's next. Maybe Antarctica or something like that will show up as the next choice. But, you know, that has happened a lot. And I think, interestingly enough, part of the problem is that if you go with the version of manufacturing that is very sort of de-skilled, meaning you're relying on a lot of automation, then you don't need highly educated people like we have in the United States. So I think there's a sort of interesting national level strategy that we need to think hard about, which is, you know, are there manufacturing sort of style jobs that we could bring back here that would leverage the fact that we have a very educated population relative to some of the places that the work is getting farmed out to. You know, and in some sense, the McDonaldization of work has really not played to our strengths, because we have a great educational system, relatively speaking, in the U.S., but then we often create a lot of jobs that don't necessarily need the skills that we've just created. And that's a pretty fundamental mismatch.
Yes, it is. It seems to be. Well, we could keep this conversation going all day. Maybe I should just come start taking some of your classes. It sounds fascinating. Well, Nelson, thank you so much for talking with me about your riding and about business and about the bike industry. So I always ask my guests three questions. What's your favorite food?
I would have to side with anything of Mexican cuisine, I would guess, probably my favorite.
Yes, let's see. Last week, Molly said tacos, so I guess that goes right along with it.
Yes, I saw you one more specific. Enchiladas verde would probably be my
meal
of choice.
Yeah, that sounds good. What music do you listen to?
You know, it's funny. All my musical tastes seem to be centered on what happened in Minneapolis in the 1980s. So Husker Du, The Replacements, Prince, I don't know what it was about Minneapolis, but that's probably 50% of my music collection right there.
And you didn't even grow up there. You grew up in Chicago.
No, I know. Exactly.
Do you have any pets?
I do not, sadly. My life does not lend itself to but I would be a dog person if I could.
Yeah, dogs are great. Well, thank you so much for talking with me. I hope we get to talk again, because it's a very interesting conversation, and I like your perspective. I think it's very broad and very knowledgeable.
My pleasure.
All right. You have a great day, and happy holidays.
All right. All right. All right. Thank you.
You're welcome. Bye. Bye-bye. Professor Nelson Repenning joined me from his office at the MIT Sloan School of Management. I told you he was smart, and I enjoyed our conversation. Let's take a break, and we'll be back to speak with Merlin Townley about all things cycling from his perspective. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
The Outspoken Cyclist podcast is supported by the Dodd Camera Company. An Ohio institution in photography for over 100 years, Dodd Camera has stayed right in step with the newest in digital cameras and accessories, as well as offering services such as photo restoration and large format printing. Dodd Camera stores are located in Cleveland, Dayton, Cincinnati, Chicago, and now Columbus in the Oak Creek Shopping Center on Cameron Avenue. If you don't have one in your town, you can find them online at doddcamera.com. At Dodd Camera, the focus is on you.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
Off we go to Vermont to speak with master mechanic Merlin Townley. Hi, Merlin. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. It's been 5 years since last time we chatted. And our last conversation was from Chattanooga, Tennessee. Now you're in Vermont.
Yes, in the middle of nowhere in Vermont. I would say if the reception is not so great, that's definitely on my end. If you could see where I was at the moment, you'd be surprised that I could make a phone call at all.
You mean like soup cans in a string, huh?
Yeah, well, sort of way out in the middle of nowhere, really. The biggest town from where I am now in northern Vermont is 8,000 people. That's our state capital. And it's, it doesn't take much to get out of town.
Right, and you're out of town, which is pretty cool. So we're going to have a different kind of conversation than we did the last time. Last time we talked about race mechanics and a bunch of other stuff. But I'm wondering more about what you've done in the cycling industry during the many years. And I think it's in the 30s.
37 years so far.
That's a long time. What kind of jobs have you had and where have they taken you? I know you've done some pretty amazing travels.
Yeah, if you saw the shop that I started in, it was Rainbow Bicycles in Providence, Rhode Island. And I think I was one of his longest-lasting employees. I think I worked there for about 6 weeks. It was the kind of shop where you had to walk heel-toe, because standing with your feet next to each other was just impossible in that shop. Big piles of used wheels that were completely completely good for nothing kind of thing. That's where I began, and it's kind of amazing that I'm still in the industry after working in that shop. I don't know. There was something about it that appealed to me, and I think that a lot of people, they get into working on bikes, and I don't know. There's something wonderful about it that you just can't really ignore it. And this was the case for me, so I kept going, and I worked in a number of different bike shops and had done a little bit of traveling with my parents. Like, I had my fifth birthday in Haiti, not to date myself too much, but that was in 1969. You know, it was kind of a crazy, awful place, but wonderful at the same time, really nice people. But I have the sneaking suspicion it really hasn't changed a lot since then, especially not even after the earthquake.
That's kind of interesting that you can sort of think back that many years. I mean, that's over 30 years, and actually it's more than that. It's over 40 years. And remember this place. I don't know if I could really remember when I was 5 years old and remember it the way you think it probably still is. Maybe it's because it's Haiti.
I don't know. I think of all the countries I've been to, I've been to more third world countries than everything else. You know, nobody ever really thinks of the second world countries. I'll bet most people couldn't even define a second world country, and I'm not sure that I could either. But you know, once you've been to Haiti, it's all irrelevant sort of anyway. Don't get me wrong. I have great memories of Haiti. Would I go back? Sure, why not? But I would not go back for the cycling industry, probably. I can't imagine that. Well, yeah, no.
Yeah, well, maybe no. A definite maybe. A definite maybe.
A definite maybe.
Right.
Cycling industry actually probably could do more for Haiti than most other things that you could do. But that's sort of a tangent, I guess. I mean, like, I had done a certain amount of traveling in my youth with my parents. That really had me hooked on traveling and seeing new things and gaining new perspectives on things. To travel the world is the best way to know more about where you live. In a way, it's like teaching yourself something, teaching something that you know to another person or to a group of people is the best way to understand what you actually really know. This is especially true in bicycles, but I think it's probably true in everything. Sort of get back on track a little bit. So I worked in bike shops for about 8 years, and found out from a friend of mine who had gone to a bike race to support his team. And although he was not in the shape to race, he wanted to work in the pit for his team. And the people that were running the pit wouldn't let him because he didn't have a race mechanics license. And this was a long time ago. This was early 90s, late 80s, early 90s. And I was like, well, that's an interesting thing. I'm going to have to find out more about that, because at 8 years working in bike shops, I had seen a fair amount and I had done a fair amount, or at least I thought I had anyway. So I called USA Cycling and inquired about it. And I talked to a guy named Bill Woodle, and we had a conversation for about half an hour on the phone. And he said, well, why don't you come out? You know, the class costs $75. And you should come out and do the class.
What year was that, Merlin?
I took the class in 1990.
And it was $75? That was it?
Yes. Wow. I believe it's 10 times that cost now. And it's being run by the PBMA this year. I know virtually nothing of what they're teaching of it now. But in previous years, it's what I would recommend to pretty much any seasoned mechanic to go take that class. Whether they become a race mechanic or not, it will open their eyes and their perspective to a new way of doing things and a new way of being just within the cycling industry. You know, the class that I took and have subsequently taught that class on and off for several years, it's an excellent class. Absolutely. At the time when I took it, you had to have worked in a shop for a minimum of 4 years. I don't know what the current requirements are. It costs 10 times what it costs when I took it. But if you're really going to open your eyes to a new world, it's really probably worth the $700 and something dollars that it is now.
How long is the class? Is it still as short as it was for you, or have they expanded it?
That class seemed like a lifetime to me. I never went to school to learn what I did. I worked in shops that had really good mechanics that had been doing it for a long time and could explain everything well, like points of reference of a frame, for example. You know, everything starts with the bottom bracket and works outwards. And there are many points of reference within that. And then outward from there, and then there are more and more and more points of reference. And those points of reference allow you to truly understand what's going on a bicycle at the most basic level and all the way out to campy EPS. I can't think of a whole lot more that's more advanced than campy EPS. 4 years was a requirement at the time when I took it. I had not yet been in the industry, let's put it that way. I think there is a distinct difference between working in a bike shop and being in the industry.
Oh, how so? Wait, let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Merlin Townley. He's up in Vermont. He is not currently in the bicycle business, but we'll talk about that in a moment. Is that correct?
Yeah, that is technically correct. The difference between being a bicycle mechanic, working in a shop, and being in the industry is considerable. I mean, technically, you could say, oh, yeah, I'm in the bicycle industry in a casual conversation, and that makes sense. But realistically, if you're in the bicycle industry, you're working for a manufacturer of some kind. You're working for something that doesn't have something to do with retail, necessarily. I mean, you may be on the back end of retail, like you may be a supplier for retail. But a supplier for retail is industry.
So you're saying shops are not necessarily in the industry. They're peripheral to the industry.
Correct.
Interesting. It's an interesting perspective, one I hadn't actually ever taken. I always considered us part of the industry.
Being in the industry is like, well, a friend of mine worked for Specialized, or still works for Specialized for that matter. He cataloged all the parts that Specialized ever used or manufactured, and he gave each one a part number. And we're talking hundreds of thousands of part numbers. It could even have reached a million, and it's an astronomical amount of parts. He currently works in international warranty for them, and he doesn't basically ever end up in a bike shop. Most people in the bike industry don't even know who he is or that his job exists.
Huh.
He kind of likes it, although he does admit that basically no one would want his job.
Right. No, not unless you're Watson, the IBM computer.
Right. I mean, like he spends a certain amount of time in Utah, and he spends a certain amount of time in Taiwan and China and wherever else they send him. To me, it sounds like a fun job. Here we are yet again on another tangent.
Well, and so I do want to get back to why you were able to do some of these things when other technicians, other mechanics seem to be somewhat like stuck where they are in their shops or in their basements or in their garages or wherever it is that, you know, that people who work on bikes end up being. You were able to sort of take off in a lot of directions.
Yeah, it's funny from taking the class, the race mechanics clinic, opened my eyes to a lot of the possibilities. And I have kind of sometimes a wild imagination, and my imagination led me to the idea that other possibilities exist beyond the racing world. It is true. There is a great deal more to the bicycle industry than most people will ever even conceive of. And every time I think that I've seen it all, a new doorway opens, and there's a whole other universe out there. You know, bike racing, what do we think of bike racing? So it's road bike racing, it's mountain bike racing. But then there's, you know, Race Across America, which is not associated with USA Cycling. There is triathlons. They're also not associated with USA Cycling. And, you know, the Race Mechanics Clinic is put on by USA Cycling. It's a great foundation. It puts all race mechanics on the same starting page. So I could, you know, come up to a Category 4 mechanic and we could have a conversation about bike racing or being a bicycle race mechanic and have at least that foundation of knowledge.
Do you think that being a race mechanic prepares you better for being a bicycle mechanic than, say, like apprenticing under somebody in a big shop, maybe in Boston or in San Francisco or in Minneapolis or something like that?
I would say it's a great thing, but it all depends on the mechanic that you apprentice with. And to apprentice with a mechanic is the best way to learn. But that mechanic that you apprentice with, you know, it depends on, you know, what they believe and what they don't. And, you know, GT spokes are the bee's knees, or they're awful, or Sapima's great, or Will Smith is great. I mean, you know, how many spoke manufacturers are there out there?
So that individual shop is going to have its preferences, or that head mechanic's going to have his or her preferences, and then that's what you learn. And do you learn more than that as a race mechanic at the USA Cycling Mechanics School?
Vastly.
Okay.
So one thing to know about becoming a race mechanic, taking that class, you're not learning how to work on bikes differently. In fact, you're not learning how to work on bikes at that clinic. And yet it's a huge eye-opener for most people that take the class. I have only had one apprentice who went to that class who was disappointed with it. She felt that she was being belittled by various instructors because she was a woman.
Oh, this is a good time for that, right?
Yeah. In my way of thinking, I never discriminate against anyone because of anything that they are or that they're not. A person has as much potential as anyone else if given the proper knowledge and opportunity. She felt that she was not given the proper opportunity, and it's unfortunate that she was treated the way that she was.
Did she leave the industry?
I don't know.
Okay.
Actually, I've lost contact with her, but the last I knew, she was still in the industry.
Oh, well, that's kind of good.
She didn't become a race mechanic, but I didn't really send her to the clinic to become a race mechanic, actually. I suggested that she go to the clinic for the knowledge that she would gain from it and the perspective that she would gain from it. And unfortunately, she came back with a less than desirable perspective of some of the instructors. I would say that is, you know, to the women out there listening, go take the class and inform your own opinion.
Right, right.
You know, and in general, don't take any shit from anybody. I don't care who they are. I don't necessarily get along with the way the industry thinks about how I should be within the industry. There are no rules and there are no laws about what I do within the industry. I've worked in 60 countries on 6 continents. I've worked in racing and in touring. I was head mechanic for the biggest bike tour ever attempted or completed, for that matter. And, you know, I was a race mechanic before that, and I was a race mechanic afterwards. And I would say that there are people out there that disagree with me about what I should be doing within the industry.
Let me remind our listeners once again, we're speaking with Merlin Townley, and I want to ask you what you see from Merlin's perspective is next for the industry, and then what's next for you. And I know we can't talk about everything that's coming up for you, but you can give us maybe sort of a hint as to what's going to be changing for you.
Right. Okay, so this year I took the year off. After 37 years in the industry, I decided I needed time off. I need to back away and think about my experience so far and gain perspective. And I've done a great deal of that in my drives, you know, from New England to San Fran and back to Atlanta and up to Maryland and back and all around, and finally moved back home to Vermont, and have, you know, spend enough time by myself to think about it, and with other people as well. I'm currently working on something that I can't really explain a whole lot about, but I can tell you a few things, and that is that it will level the playing field between bike shops and mechanics. And the problem that mechanics have is that they can't make a living doing what they do. And, you know, people want you know, you see the ads in Bicycle Retailer or the UBI job board or any of those. Everybody wants 2 years experience, but they also want you to be able to tune up a bike, true wheels, build wheels, know about frame alignment, and all these other things along with DI2 and ETAP and EPS. You know, there's just not enough time in 2 years of working in a bike shop to be able to know how to do all that stuff at an expert level.
So let me ask you a question real quick before you go on, and that is, do you think that the average person going into a bike shop to purchase a bike or to have a bike repaired understands what goes on the other side of that service counter? Do you think that they really realize that perhaps a 17-year-old working on your bike or even a 25-year-old who's only had a year or so working on your bike doesn't always give you the best results? Or do you think that they just trust that they're getting what they're getting?
I'm sure that they have no idea. And to those people that are, you know, listening to this, I would suggest that you find out as much as you can about who's going to be working on your bike. And a blanket statement of, oh, we have great mechanics, isn't enough.
Right. Everybody says that.
If you've dropped, you know, $5,000, $10,000, $20,000 on a bicycle, which is, you know, $20,000 may seem like, oh my God, that's an unbelievable amount of money. I've walked into bike shops and been standing there when someone sold a $40,000 bicycle. But who works on those kinds of bikes? And it's not that 17-year-old kid.
Well, hopefully not.
Yeah, I certainly hope not, actually, because the 17-year-old kid doesn't have enough experience. He, of course, thinks that he does.
Well, yeah, because he's 17, right? Exactly.
And worse yet, maybe even 15. I'm not sure that that's legal in this country, but that never stopped the bicycle industry before.
Do you think that the bicycle mechanic needs to have that contact with the customer? Or sometimes you have the person out front is taking in the bike, writes up the service ticket, the bike goes to the back of the shop, and all that the mechanic sees is what that person wrote down. The bike is fixed, they send it back out, and they never heard that, oh yeah, every time I turn the pedals, I get a click on the right side. Or every time I do this, you know, I'm hearing a sound in my rear wheel. And then the bike comes back, and you know, that's the kiss of death, that, you know, I never getting it right the first time.
Right. Yeah, that the getting it right the first time is always so important, especially if you want that customer to come back a third time. And realistically, that's the way it should be.
Unfortunately, we're going to need to wrap it up. So when can we find out what you're going to be doing next? When are you going to be able to tell us you're ready to launch your new venture?
On that subject, I would say not only will it level the playing field a little bit, which is kind of a vague statement, but it will increase the pay for mechanics considerably.
Well, that would be a good thing.
That would be a good thing. I mean, do you really want a $9 an hour mechanic working on your $20,000 bike?
Right. That's such a great question.
Probably not. And do you want to have a personal relationship with that mechanic? Well, you certainly should. There is a way to make it so that you can get the work that you need done professionally by a pro, not pay too much for it, and for that mechanic to make $25, $30 an hour, which I don't know that there's a whole lot of mechanics out there that would turn down that kind of money.
Well, I hope it comes to pass soon and that you'll let me know when it does. In the meantime, I have three questions for you that you have to answer. They're very simple. What's your favorite food?
Oh, my favorite food is certainly seafood.
Oh, yeah.
Spent a lot of time on the coast and, you know, many different countries, many different continents, and it's always the best, really.
And what kind of music do you like to listen to? I think you have a reputation for certain kinds of music.
I do, actually. I have a reputation for listening to a lot of electronic music, and I love electronic music, but I also love, you know, certain kinds of jazz, older stuff, really.
Nice.
Fats Waller and things like that, and you know, 80s music. I was there in the 80s, so I love all that. You know, did college. You know, went to RISD in the 80s. So
nice. I didn't know that.
Oh yeah.
Do you have any pets?
No, I don't have pets, but I live with two pets, and I consider myself to be theirs.
I see.
More than them, mine. They belong to my girlfriend. So
nice.
An awesome Maine Coon cat and a fantastic, reasonably, almost always well-behaved rat terrier.
Well, Merlin, thank you so much for talking with me today. And I will be anxious to hear what your next venture is that's going to help technicians in our industry actually make a living so that they can do things like buy a house and put their kids through school and have health insurance. Those are important things these days.
Health insurance. What's that?
Yeah, exactly. You have a great day and thanks for talking with me.
Awesome. Thank
All
you
right.
too.
Take care.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Merlin Townley joined me from his home in Vermont. I can't wait to hear what's next for him and for the bike world. We're going to take another quick break and then speak with Doug Bonick about his new book, The White Line to Denver, and to see how he's doing. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. Hi, Doug. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me in the studio today.
Well, thanks for having me.
It is my pleasure. As I told you before we are getting started today, that every week for the last, it's probably been about 5 weeks, and we're going to go for another two, we suggest a gift. And today we're suggesting a gift called The White Line to Denver, your new book.
Why, thank you.
You are welcome. It's been many years since I've seen you. And this particular book is about a ride you did from Boise, Idaho to Denver, yes?
That's correct.
And when was that?
That was in 2007.
Well, it's interesting because anybody who remembers my last conversation with Doug, he had just gotten back from Alaska from riding, and everybody goes, oh, those are really cool trips. Only what you don't know, perhaps, is Doug rides and is a Parkinson's. Would you call yourself a patient?
They like to call themselves Parkinson's people, but Parkinson's patient is okay with me.
Okay, Parkinson's person.
Person, right.
Person. Okay, so besides the fact that that's so, this is your first book?
Yes, it is.
And you are already writing another book?
Yes, I have a follow-up coming to this one from Denver to Boston.
Oh, cool. So it's sort of like following the white line, which is the point of the title, The White Line to Denver. Let's talk about the book. So tell me a couple of stories from the book. You started in Boise, so maybe at that end.
Okay, well, I started in Boise, and I decided that first day I was going to ride 100 miles. And so I did, and I kind of regretted it because I got butt blisters, and which made the rest of the trip very uncomfortable for me. But I kept on riding along, and when I got to a place called Bliss, I saw another bicyclist up ahead. I thought, oh boy, another bicyclist, another touring guy. I got up to him, and I was pretty sure after I met him that he wasn't really a cycling person at all. He's just a guy up there riding a bicycle. And he told me that his brakes were loose. And did I have a wrench to tighten up his brakes? And I said, sure, I do. Let's go to that truck station over there, and I'll tighten them up for you. So he rode over there, and as soon as we got over there, this woman came out screaming at him, Chris, what are you doing here? Get out of here, Chris. You're not supposed to be here. Except she was using much stronger language than that. And Chris said, well, I just need to tighten up my brakes. And she's threatened to call the cops on him and everything else. And she's really quite mean.
What did this poor guy do?
Nothing that I knew of.
At least he was telling you.
Right. He probably had some past with her, but I don't know what that was.
Oh, that's really
strange.
Yeah,
but he finally left and everything was okay. And she went back to her job as a waitress and everything was fine.
So I have a question back up a little bit about these saddle sores. You actually didn't stop, let them heal. You kept on riding?
You don't have a choice.
Oh, my poor butt hurts thinking about it.
Yeah.
So what did you do? Did you like bandage them up or use saddle cream or?
Well, I eventually met a guy named Bob who helped me across Utah. And Bob knew a lot of people in Utah. He made his living by conducting bike tours.
Oh, nice.
So he came to one of the people that he knew, and this guy sold something called butt butter. And so I put those on the saddle sores, and they seemed to help quite a bit. So that's what I used.
Is that the first you've heard of that?
Yep.
And you've been riding a few years. That's interesting. So tell us what was the most difficult part of this trip between Boise and Denver?
It was probably going up to Park City, because I went a little bit and I just felt like I was dying going up that hill.
Hill or mountain?
It was a mountain.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it just kept on going on and on and on and on. And it was just a very hard ride up there. And what I had to do is play little games. I'd have to say, oh, I'm going to just go up to that rock over there, and then I'll stop. And then I get to that rock, and I say, oh, I'll just go up to that little piece of grass up there, and then I'll take another break. But I would never take the breaks. I would just pick another a goal ahead of me and make it up there. And I finally, after many hours, finally made it to the top of that mountain.
And did you stay up there for the night?
No, we decided to ride a little bit further, because they wanted $100 a night for the hotel rooms there.
Ooh.
And I wasn't willing to spend that money in those days.
In Park City?
In Park City. So I went to Heber City instead of Park City. And Heber City was only $75 a night, and so I stayed there.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Doug Bonnick. He's telling us about his new book, The White Line to Denver. It's from a trip he did from Boise to Denver back in 2007, did you tell me?
2007, correct.
2007. And Doug has been with us in the past, and so we'll get a little into why it's so impressive that Doug can do these kinds of events against the better judgment of his physicians and probably his wife at this point. What about the traffic? Were you ever afraid in traffic? I mean, we've sort of gotten to the point where we prefer riding trails because traffic's so awful.
Well, that's an interesting question, because what I decided on that trip was to try to ride on the freeway as much as possible.
They let you do that?
They let you do that.
Oh, that's even scarier.
In Idaho, you have all the privileges of a car on the freeway. In Utah, I'm not quite sure what the rule is, but I know you're allowed to ride on the freeway. And in Colorado, you can ride on the freeway as long as there's not a practical alternative way that you can ride.
Wow.
So the laws out west are quite a bit different from here.
Well, probably population is much smaller. So, you know, there's only one way to get from point A to point B, perhaps.
Well, that's true. But I also think it's a lot safer riding on the freeway, because when you ride on the freeway, cars are passing you at 60 miles an hour, but there's a good 6 feet away from you. When you ride on a secondary road, cars still travel at 60 miles an hour, but they're only a couple feet from you. And there's always a much higher risk of collision, I feel.
Hmm. Interesting. Did you ever feel like, well, first of all, let me ask you, what was the distance between Denver and Boise?
It was about 900 miles altogether.
Did you ever feel like quitting?
Of course.
Every day? But you didn't.
No, I did not. No. The time I probably felt really the closest to quitting was going up Loveland Pass.
And oh, yeah.
Loveland Pass is really a hard, hard pass for a guy to ride up. And to me, Loveland Pass was just a... it was such a big goal for me. It was just the reason I was riding up that doing this whole ride was to ride up Loveland Pass. And I had practiced for Loveland Pass by here in Cleveland. We don't have those kind of rides, but I would go out to Old Mill Road. I don't know if you do you know Old Mill?
Oh, sure. We ride down it.
Yeah. So I'd go up Old Mill once or twice or three times a day just to try to build up my strength for Loveland Pass. But what happened when I was going up there, I met two other guys, and three of us started riding together. Eventually, they passed me and took off by themselves. Of course, they weren't lugging 40 pounds of gear with them.
Right.
But, so anyway, they went on up ahead of me, and I almost got to the top, and I was ready to quit. And I stood there, and I thought, oh, I just can't do this anymore. I've just given it my all. I just couldn't do it. And there's a guy up there working on a road crew, and I asked him, do you mind if I wait here for a few minutes and catch my breath? And he said, go ahead, buddy, take all the time you want. So I just stood there for about 15 minutes. I finally caught my breath again, and I went on. And as I approached the top, those other two guys and some other friends of theirs all started cheering me on. And they're yelling, go, 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 go. And I thought, oh, my goodness. And I just started crying.
Now I can't quit.
Now I can't quit. I just started crying because it was such an emotional moment for me. And later on that day, when I stayed at a motel, they were playing The Sound of Music on the television set there.
The Hills Were Alive?
Yes. And every time they would play that, I would start to cry because I was so emotional about that
sure.
ride up that hill.
You know, part of what it sounds like to me as far as your making these goals, whether they were just getting to the next rock, getting to the next piece of grass, getting up level and pass, whatever it is overcoming this horribly debilitating disease that you have. How are you feeling?
Well, it depends on the day.
Well,
it really depends on the day and depends on how well my medications are helping me. I've done everything I can to combat Parkinson's, including I've had brain surgery. I've had deep brain stimulator inserted in my brain. It helps me quite a bit. But then the medicines themselves also are an important part of the issue. So I have to make sure to take the right amount of medicine and to take it on time. And if I do all those things and I'm a little bit lucky, I feel great. The interesting thing about all of this is if I go spinning, I can just spin as fast as I want. But when I get off that spinning bike and start to walk, it's very difficult for me to walk. So there's this inverse relationship almost between the two of them.
That's interesting because I know research has shown that tremors are quieted by getting into some sort of rhythmic pedaling, and yet nobody ever talks about when you're done.
Right.
Interesting.
Right. Interesting.
Yeah.
I can spin those. When I go spinning, I try to spin it sometimes up to 120 RPM. So it's not like I'm taking a break or anything. I mean,
right.
I'm really pushing myself as hard as I can.
Well, you are getting ready for another ride.
I am.
Or you're not. Oh, you're just
ready.
Yes,
I am.
Oh, that's what I thought. Yeah. You are always getting ready. What are you doing next?
Well, I'd like to do another Ride the Rockies.
The organized Ride
right.
the Rockies.
Right.
Was that ride canceled last year?
No.
Oh, it was the Utah ride that was canceled last year for fires.
Yeah, I rode Ride the Rockies last year.
Yeah. And wait a minute. You're talking Loveland Pass. Now you're going to do Ride the Rockies. How hard is that event?
Well, it's really quite difficult, I'll be honest. And one of the reasons I'd like to do Ride the Rockies now is I'm forced to take a sag wagon occasionally. And so they're happy to give you a ride.
You don't take gear on that ride on the bike, though.
No, not on the bike.
Okay, so it's a little bit lighter, a little bit easier, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, are you still riding your Scatante?
Not on those rides.
Okay, what are you riding on those rides?
On those rides, I've been riding my Zebra Kanko.
You have a Zebra Kanko?
Yeah, I have a Zebra Kanko.
We've never talked about that. I was the original Zebra Kanko dealer in Cleveland. You must have gotten that bike from me.
I did buy it from you.
Oh, my gosh.
And I still have it.
What color is it?
Purple.
I was just going to say, is it really one of the purple ones? They were beautiful, beautiful bikes.
I love it.
Yeah, those were actually, that's a long story, Zebra Kanko. How interesting, Doug. Now you're telling me 40 years later that you bought it from me. That's hilarious. Well, let's tell people how they can get a copy of your book. Again, the name of the book is The White Line to Denver. It's by Doug Bonnick. It is a fun book. I haven't read it all, I have to be honest. I've read quite a bit of it, and it's the way you write is fun. It's sort of the way you talk, so it's kind of an interesting book.
Well, thank you.
Where can people get a copy?
They can get it at lulu.com. That's lulu.com, and they can just go in there and search for the book. And in the search part of the thing, they can type in The White Line to Denver, and it'll pop right up, and then all you have to do is order it, and you'll have it.
Well, it would be a nice gift, perhaps, for the cyclist in your life. Everybody loves new books for the holidays. Thank you so much for taking time to come into the studio. Lots of luck. And someday we'll sit down and talk about your Zebra Kanko. How's that?
Sounds great.
All right. Thanks, Doug.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Doug Bonnick lives, writes, rides, and works right here in Northeast Ohio. His new book, The White Line to Denver, is available from the publisher, lulu.net, or from Doug at dougb@copper.net. That's our show for this week. I'd like to thank Professor Nelson Repenning, Master Mechanic Merlin Townley, and Doug for taking time to talk with me. It looks like we're headed into yet another week of fall. So for those of you who were hoping for early snow in Northeast Ohio, I'm sorry, sort of. I hope everyone listening has a great week. And remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.